This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This is Pop Culture Confidential, and I'm Christina Yerling-Biru. Hey everyone, welcome to Pop Culture Confidential, a part of the Evergreen Podcast Network. So way before COVID-19 engulfed the world, showrunner Patrick Somerville was pitching his idea for the show Station 11. It's a post-apocalyptic show about joy, a show about our need to feel, he said. Now, was that really possible? And now, many, many months into the real pandemic, the show has premiered, and yes, it was possible. And yes, we do need to feel. And for anyone who's followed me knows that I was just blown away by this show. I felt. I met Patrick Somerville and his producing partner, Jessica Rhodes, in our three boxes over Zoom, as is the way in the new order. And I was thrilled to talk to them. Patrick Somerville is a novelist who wrote on Damon Lindelof's The Leftovers and is the creator of Maniac. Patrick Somerville adapted his friend Emily St. John Mandel's 2014 novel Station 11 into a 10-part miniseries. Executive producer Jessica Rhodes has shows like Utopia, Sharp Objects, The Affair, and The Village to her name. The series Station 11 follows several interconnected characters through different timelines, maneuvering before and after a devastating pandemic where billions died of a respiratory illness with a 99% fatality rate. We meet characters like Jeevan, played by Himesh Patel, who through a chance meeting with a child actor, Kirsten, played by Matilda Lawler, ends up caring for her. A Shakespearean troupe that travels the Great Lake regions performing for survivors, as art really has the power to heal. My conversation with Patrick and Jessica ranges from stories of the production to some deep thoughts on the human condition as portrayed in their show, about the powerful themes so relevant considering the collective trauma that we all are in now, like grief and reuniting with someone you thought you lost. But also how audiences really don't want twists. That's the old Damon Lindelof rule. How much damage a book like The Lord of the Flies has done to Western civilization. And how airports really are museums of civilization. A word of warning, we do talk about the entire series, 10 episodes, so there will be spoilers. Here is my conversation with Patrick Somerville and Jessica Rhodes. But first, Station 11.
Stay with me, sir. Stay with me.
Clear! Where's your mom or dad?
I don't know.
I can't leave you here. I'll walk you to the elf.
I think this thing is really happening. You can see it out there.
Can I have your attention, please? We have shelter. We have food. This is the best thing that could have possibly happened.
We're the Traveling Symphony. We travel for a reason. Just try to make the world make sense for a minute.
No one finds people from before.
Jeevan! Mr. Somerville, Miss Rhodes, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
I remember the last person to call me Miss Rhodes.
Miss?
So I've been doing this for a couple decades now, but in preparation, I started to feel really self-conscious because I've been thinking so much about your show that I realized that in my questions, I'm going to reveal myself, where I cried, the feelings I have about underdogs and life choices.
Just lay down on our couch right here. Just go right ahead. We're lying
Welcome
down
to
on
our
couches.
Emails and our text messages. I feel like a lot of people are.
Yes, because that's what I was going to say. that I've heard that I'm definitely not the only one. You get a lot of thank yous for good cries. Why do you think that is, that the reaction is so personal to this show?
Jessica, I'd love to hear what you have to say.
Well, I think the reaction to the story would have always been personal because everyone experiences trauma, small and large. But there is something that we as humans have gone through collectively, you know, a collective trauma in the last few years. But I also think as caregivers, there's a very specific trauma, this need to keep going, keep walking, like Jeevan says, you know, to kind of, even when you're scared, to hide that and to create, to mask, you know, that's not exactly what Jeevan says, but
we,
you know,
pretend,
this idea.
Yeah, we're the grown-ups. We pretend.
The grown-ups. That, yeah. We have to pretend, there it is. We have to pretend we're not scared. It's Frank. You know, I think that idea is everyone, whether actually parents or friends or teachers or nurses, there's so many people who caregive each other, friends. And I think so many people just kept marching for the last couple of years. And there's something about just sitting in that that's a little cathartic, is my hunch.
Yeah, our culture in America in particular, I don't know what culture, but I actually, maybe I can think of some that are much more open to emotional expressions from adults. Like, and it can be gendered, like men crying is problematic. I think if you're at the high council of men, the gender control zone, or, and I think, like, you know, at work and showing emotional work, there's not a lot of space in America already, but I think we've gone through something that is bigger than that. And I think we just need to feel and communicate how we feel. And what the other thing I'll say is, I was talking to one of our writers, Sarah McCarron, yesterday about the hug. Like, why? Because the hug
me, between Jeevan and Kristen.
Yeah. At the end of episode 10, it's funny because we pitched the show and kind of conceived of the big moments before the pandemic. And I told the story of the hug in the pitch meetings and often got tears there. And I think there's something deeper about reuniting with someone you thought you lost that is going on there, that I think the way this show played out, it became our emotional moments became our story waypoints. And so because of that, the language of the show somehow is in an empathic space more than sometimes they are. There's something about grieving too. We haven't really talked about this, Jessica and I, but you know, I'll speak for myself. I lost my dad 4 years ago now, and I went right back to work 2 weeks later and made a whole show, made Maniac. And there's a bit of the Wisconsin worker blue collar element to it, where it's sort of like, I'll power through that. I don't think powering through anything ever works, actually. And it feels like it's working at the time, but grieving takes years, and it has layers and has profound kind of, it comes back. And we are grieving so much right now, but have not had time or space, because we're keeping our households together and like our sanity intact. We have a lot of grieving we have to do of the lost. Like, we've lost a million people, more. We've lost, our kids have lost childhood. We've lost a lot. And like, it takes space and time and creativity to grieve, and just more years than we've had. So I think this is just sort of speaking to what Jessica said, like there's a lot of big feelings encased in caverns inside of us that need to be there a bit. And I think the show kind of pops some stuff open.
But I think you also have to be in an extremely safe place to pop those things open. And I think something that Patrick and the entire team cared deeply about was letting the audience know they were in safe hands. You know, our show has surprising reveals, but it's not trying to catch you off guard. It's not trying to trick you. It's not trying to mislead. You know, I think there's a very something I've heard in conversations is you feel safe watching it, and I think that lets people's guards down to kind of access their own emotions of wherever we meet them, where they're at.
It's so unusual for a show like this that the promise at the end is that we're going to keep finding ways to love each other, to take care of each other. I mean, it's not a Lord of the Flies type of deal that I think people have gotten so used to.
I think nothing did more damage to Western civilization than the novel Lord of the Flies.
Do you guys remember that article a few years ago, the bunch of schoolboys that were the real story, they were marooned in 1965, and it turns out that it was not like that at all. These
Guess
boys
what?
Helped each other the whole time.
They made a perfect anarcho-syndicalist commune that helped each other and were not incentivized to undermine each other at all. Look what we do. Look what we do when left to our own devices.
So Jessica, the book came out in 2014. You started this project a long time before COVID-19. Was there at any point since you were filming when it started that people said, oh gosh, we're in an actual pandemic now? You had pressure to change the storyline at all?
Well, we had already shot episodes 1 and 3, Hero Mirai's directed episodes, when that, you know, very, very shortly before. And so I think as we were in the edit and we were looking at it, we kind of knew the connection between the material and what was really happening in the world was maybe fraught, you know, maybe was going to be something that you didn't emotionally want to continue, you know, kind of as an audience watch, but we just trusted, I think, ourselves, I think it's fair to say, and we still wanted to make it. We desperately wanted to be in these stories coming together and making these stories. And I think that it helped, obviously, that those two episodes existed, but those are the hardest episodes to watch, frankly, in pandemic head, right? In oh my gosh, this is a real thing. That's a real thing. And so I can't speak for Patrick. I can just speak for myself and those of us, like, something about this show was going to feel good for us, was going to be good for us emotionally. And I think that we just had faith, everyone involved with the studio and network as well, that feeling that was going to feel right to us was going to feel right to the audience.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Now, in our group of pandemic survivors in Station 11, I don't know what you want to call them, but I sort of see them as underdogs. You have Jeevan, who's sort of the rudderless of the siblings, a bit more than the others, the wonderfully complex Clark, who is always never sort of been in the lead. You have Tyler, the overlooked child. It's interesting. I think that you've chosen a lot of people, or the book as also, that get second chances.
Certainly. And this is something that we talked explicitly about in the writer's room. And I think there's something to the fact that the writer's room happened before the pandemic that is part of the bigger conversation we just started, that we were always sort of pointed in a direction that was toward a unusual examination of this genre and like healing centered. But I think a lot of a conversation that came up a lot was, if catastrophe strikes, there are new kinds of you that can grow. That doesn't mean that they're good. that can mean any new kind of you. That can mean a more empowered you, but that can also, in Clark's case, mean a mad king. You know, like if we have a bunch of pent up stuff that is not explored, and then we get a lot of power, suddenly I think like that's dangerous, because he's very good at some things and very bad at some things. So he's very good at convincing people to listen to him and very bad at like making the right choice sometimes, or taking care of himself. He's self-destructive. So I think it was like, we really wanted to tell stories where, okay, there's a before and then there's a rift and there's a new space. Sometimes a new flower grows, and sometimes a invasive weed grows. and I think it's not just good news. And that's especially true because it's not good news that 8 billion people died and we suffered unbelievable amounts of suffering. It's not good, but maybe something good can come in moments of great cataclysm in the future.
For example, the baby apocalypse, or as I heard someone else call it, was bed, birth, and beyond.
Oh, yeah, that, was Joanna from The Prestige. Yeah.
Yes, that was amazing. That's sort of Jeevan's sort of path there. This is not in the book. Can you talk about how this came up and what your thoughts were around this?
Sure, I could, but I'd like to hear Jessica talk about it.
Jessica?
Well, I mean, you can speak to it from a writerly point. I think that, you know, it was important. One of the beauties in the adaptation for me as a part of it, but also as a viewer and lover of the book, is I did want to know more about so many pieces we didn't get to see in the book. And so, you know, for Patrick and the team, where Jeevan's journey came from, where he got to, you know, where we found him, was new for the series from the book. But I'm, you know, he's asking me because I'm such a lover of this episode.
That's not the only reason. You're a mom. I think we've heard from dads talking about what it's like to be a mom enough.
Well, I think it honestly speaks to, I think what the idea of episode 9 and Jeevan's journey was a little bit, it's funny, the conversation we just had about Lord of the Flies and, you know, what really happens. And I think the idea of like one female doctor would create a labor maternity, you know, up center, and women would help each other. And I think that there's the moment where Laura says, "I'm in labor, but I can also help." I think that spoke to any, I'll say, any, I hope any woman who's ever, you know, given birth, there's only so many examples that in the television and film space where a woman's not losing her mind somewhere instead of having like, peaceful, methodical moment where you're also, I don't know, bringing life into the world. And in this case, repopulating, and, you know,
doing actual, that word gets used as like an experience, but it is work. You are doing work for hours to bring for months, and then years ahead in advance. And I'll just say too, to yes, and Jessica's point, I'm sitting in my office in Echo Park right now, and the day, I signed the lease, I wanted to bring my wife to come see it to make sure the vibe was right because she has good vibe sensors. And she was in labor. She came, we drove, and she's like, "I think I'm in labor." And then we were walking around and looking. She's like, "Yep, definitely." And then, you know, our baby came 6 hours later, but she was walking around assessing the quality of the light at our spot. And like speaking, like stories that have done terrible damage to Western civilization. Number one, Lord of the Flies. Number two, every story that shows a woman screaming at her husband, "You did this to me," not in control of herself. It's like a joke or something. Like, that's just not it. That is just not it.
One of my favorite things that we have, we almost framed it for the nursery, but that felt wrong, is for my second child, I have my call sheet, my work, all the calls I need to make. And on the side of it are my contractions being timed. And I just kind of was just keeping going until it got to form. And I was like, "Oh, all right. I really got to, stop now." You know,
were you rolling calls too on another sheet?
I was. My husband loved it. But it's like, I think that, But to me, I think the most important thing as it relates to Jeevan is, yes, we were able to create that world, but no one tells him how to help. I think that it's a really important trait when he's told, like, just, "It's Jeevan, go help. Like, just help. Like, you don't always have to follow directions to be taught." I think in terms of also, you can just listen to your, you know, to really pay attention and listen. And that is how you help. That is how you learn, in his case, to be a healer.
I feel like Jessica's saying it in the nice way right now. And just, I feel like it's annoying to ask someone, "How do I help?" Because that it's like, learn it. You're smart. Men, I'm speaking to you. It's a thing to say, I want to help, but I don't know how can I?" That's a new job you're creating for the person that you're asking to assist. So like, figure it out yourself, man.
My mom used to say that growing up, "I can't help you, help me."
There you go. Bang.
And I like don't think I understood it as like, by the way, like a woman in the world at the time. I just remember as a kid being like, but I just need, where's the thing for the window?
But another thing that when he's delivered the baby, and if you leave with orchestra maneuvers in the dark, we've seen a little bit of Pretty in Pink in the beginning. Dr. Terry raises her arms in that John Hughes, you did it. That's like the scene where every underdog in a John Hughes movie gets the love that they deserve at the end. I think there was so much like just muscle memory from all this pop culture that just came through with that song there.
Thank you, John Hughes. You gave us a little language to tell our story with a little bit better, I think.
But what I wanted to get to was the importance of art. And you mix these high and low. You have Shakespeare, you have the graphic novel, the Independence Day speech, the incredible Tribe Called Quest scene. You guys, what piece of art has saved you from trauma or in trauma?
Station 11.
Yeah.
If I'm being honest.
Station 11 over the last two, yeah.
But I would, I know your question didn't quite mean that, but back in college, I've only really been depressed once, I think, in life. I don't think I'm predisposed, but I got kind of stuck in a bog sophomore year of college for, I don't know, 3 or 4 months. There was a novel called Dog of the South by Charles Portis that I found right in that time. And I took a summer class, kind of got depressed the second, like on day one of the class, got the syllabus and all the books and immediately quit the class and went home to my parents' house and was kind of not okay for a little bit. But I had Dog of the South and I read it, and it was Charles Portis just wrote fiction in a way that released me from something that I felt like I was stuck in. As someone who is aspiring to be a writer, I was sort of stuck in the canon, in like Syria, like something. And he's just so funny and so wry and so humane and warm, but he's so very good at making fun of idiocy, and he does it with voice. And it was just a combination of all of these elements of the craft that I didn't know you could remix into this way and do it this way. And I read that book that summer, maybe 4 times. I just read it 4 times in a row. I've never done that before or since. Dog of the South. And I was like, what is this magic? And I really think I slowly kind of crawled my way out of the thing that I was in by holding on to like one rope that was there, Dog of the South. And it just, I was so lucky that I found it right then. I don't know what that summer would have been like without it.
So the ending is just amazing, especially as a parent. Patrick, it's not very twisty. It's very comforting. And one of the things you said, that this comes straight from Lindelof's school of twists. People don't like twists, you've said. Could you explain that a bit more?
Well, so Damon always, you know, Damon is the king of the twists. I should this is the person who crafted Walkabout, one of the best episodes of TV ever made. And then he also was responsible for the finale of season 3, we have to get back to the island episode when Jack has a beard. And I remember I read a quote from him he gave at the time. I didn't know him then, I just was a fan, who said it was so exciting to know that we had figured out a big one. And it was like being a kid hiding behind the couch when your parents are with their friends watching a show and you've all managed to sneak up behind the couch and you're going to jump out and go boo and surprise them, and they didn't know you were there. Like, we had him. And I'm like, he loves that kind of thing. But Damon's, I think, insight always is like, you have to give people the evidence in advance that it's coming. Like, you know, when you're the parent, you hear your kids creeping up back there, you know, they're there. You have to have a couple kind of ways of easing people into being ready for it. And like, you know, Kirsten and Jeevan reuniting isn't a twist. It's like, it's just what everyone wants so badly.
You gave us that.
The only thing we did was make it seem like maybe they were going to miss each other. And that was never going to be the way Station 11 operated. There's a really amazing Freakonomics episode of their podcast that goes deeper into this question. I wish I could name it. I can't right now, but anyone who likes, there's a podcast about twists that gets into this matter about like what people want. And then because people feel really upset, I think, if you don't do the work at the front end, like it's, I don't know of a good example, like Sixth Sense, Usual Suspects are so money mm-hmm. in those moments like, well, I can't believe this is happening, but I knew, but I didn't know. But there's, what's a good example of one that's sort of like, that's not fair.
I don't need to, we don't need
you
to
know, we them. Don't need to ding someone. We've already taken
yes,
on Lord
we
of the
know
Flies.
Now.
Yeah, no, they have their own. I think it's,
we've already dissed one of the most important books. In
your words, not mine.
Yeah. Okay. One of the things that's so amazing with the show is time and how important, I really got a feeling of how important it is to live in the now. And how you are, you know, cutting back and forth. How much of that was scripted? How much was editing?
Well, it's the novel, really, that informed that idea at the start. And I think Emily's novel is like our show in that the past is present. And they're both riding with you at the same time. This is my experience. Like, my dad haunts me and advises me and is dead. And I remember being six with him, and it's all here right now. So I would say, to answer your question, most of it's scripted, the big ones, you know,
end of episode two,
and Kirsten's, the text messages, Clark and Arthur fighting in episode eight. What are some other big examples? The way things flowed around in seven, with the two characters embodied, but then
with Mackenzie yelling at Alex.
Oh, right. Oh, yes. And
that's
so,
big.
But then I think if you set the intention at the top, at the script level, then you have opportunities in the post level to double down on that idea. So, you know, there's examples of things that weren't scripted that were little flickers and flashes throughout that we found as opportunities once we knew, like, this is the idea of the show.
It was a language you really built in the script, and then the incredible editors were able to use that language to kind of, I think, script other, create other moments too. But I think it's also, it was such a, like, one of my favorite things is once Kirsten and Jeevan are back together at 10, we don't flash to the past anymore.
Exactly.
Now is now.
So I was a kid. I spent a lot of time in airports as a kid, alone, because we lived in LA. My father lived in Indonesia. I pulled three teeth waiting when I was, because I had nothing to do. But
wait,
I saw,
literally?
Yeah, I was just sitting there. I had loose teeth. I just had nothing to do. And I remember there was a woman who was supposed to be sort of looking after me at one of the airports. But she was, and finally, when I came with the third tooth, she was like, "No, no more teeth, please." It was just,
by the way, that right there is the Station 11 sharp objects mashup right there.
Yes.
the teeth. You had a Wrangler.
But exactly. Like
it needs to be said. Yeah.
But I was going to say is that I saw people grieving. I saw people in love. I saw people coming and going. I saw all these nationalities. I mean, and I was thinking it really is the Museum of Civilization, even though it's not a pandemic. And Jessica, talk a little bit about this set.
Yeah, I mean, by the way, Ruth Ammon, our incredible production designer, also a lover of airports,
yeah,
and spending time in them and kind of watching the world work and all the things you speak of. I mean, the incredible thing about the airport and the genius of Ruth and ambition of the show is we built a portion of the airport in an airport, but then many portions of it in other spaces. And, you know, this show needed to have it evolve from a space that was familiar to so many of us coming and going. And, you know, for some people they love an airport, and other people it represents some purgatory, you know, and I think it had to be.
I love an airport.
but I think it had to be that. It was that for Clark, you know, like it had to be that just space you were stuck in.
On your way to get to where you're trying to go. I love airports. You know what's amazing? Seeing people making out in an airport. Like if you're just standing on the like moving walkway and you look over and two people are just like deeply emotional because it's a goodbye or a hello, or strangers who meet at airport. That's a very exciting story too. Like, yeah, anything can happen in those places.
Yeah, I have a good one about that. Again, when I was like six or seven, on a flight I used to take a lot from Los Angeles, where we lived, to my dad, Arnold Schwarzenegger would take that same flight quite often. He wasn't all that famous then. I think he just was doing like Conan the Barbarian or something. But he was really nice to me. And a few times he sort of remembered me and said hi. But once when we deboarded the plane, I walked by him and he was making out tremendously with his girlfriend. Nothing unusual, but for a six-year-old, that shocked me.
It's terrifying. Gigantic man.
Yes. I don't know why I said that story, but lots of things happen in airports.
Get the chopper.
Anyway, Jessica, in 2020, I read something you said, and I can't believe it's already almost 2 years ago, but you wrote, "Could it be for all the connections this virus has severed, it may have forced us to carve out solutions that will ultimately increase our human bandwidth." Has it?
When did I say that?
I said this in a Variety article about productions in general.
Oh, yeah. I do think it's so, I mean, it's funny because we started talking about how we're in these squares now talking to each other. And I think that we're now on the other side of having spent, I think, 2 years here. And, you know, that was on the beginning of it. But I do think what it taught, you know, I was speaking specifically about post and how we had come to accept that a large portion of humans would just have to spend their time away from their family waiting, not working, not doing or creating, but waiting for other people. And that what I think is kind of amazing about what the pandemic has taught us is that as much as many of us want to be back in the world and want to be socializing and want to be back even in our places of work, we can do it. We are flexible enough to create other ways to connect, other ways to build schedules, other ways to whatever. And so I think that, I think that in some weird ways, we are now much more, I'll say just for myself, sorry. And Patrick, I think can attest to this. I talk about my kids all the time now. I talk about my family all the time now. Those were things I didn't really in the workspace. That was my life and other people had their life. And, you know, I think now those worlds have bled. I don't think people have like black and white anymore. They'd have the home space and the workspace or the friend space. And I don't think we lost the ability to. Everyone saw us, you know, for exactly what we are. People saw kids rushing behind us. People, you know, I hear all the time now with like very important calls, kids in the background, people at the group, like people have just like become more human, I would say. And I think in that there is something pretty astounding in connection.
Well, we were human, but maybe pretending that things were more siloed than they are actually. Like it's a good reminder to remember the person on the other in the other box is probably having a day as complicated as yours. But like the box makes you not think it, but the pandemic makes you remember it. It's a strange new remix kind of how we navigate professional and personal in our country.
Patrick, you started this project, you read the book already, your friend's book in 24, and you wanted to do something about sort of a post-pandemic joy. And at the same time, it's so weird that you're doing this and we have, you know, how strange is that we're going through a real pandemic. Do you see that there is joy for real? I mean, that these things that you guys, these themes that you've been working on, is it that way?
I mean, the world's a world. There's some joy and a lot of struggling, and we live in a very unequal world too. So I would say that like I would be an idiot to say that joy is you know, everywhere, but I would say like it's in a lot of places that you don't expect it to be, and I think that we're in the same boat when we get out of this pandemic that we were before. We just might have some new tools, hopefully, but the world's messed up and like we built it. And so I think I would love to live in a future that has more space for joy. Whether or not that's going to be true, I don't know. Let's get through COVID and see what happens.
What's next for you guys?
Jessica?
Can you say?
We're currently casting a show right now.
Together?
together.
And we have some exciting things going on together. This was a really special show. I know we all have other things going on, other producers too, and the actors, and you know, everyone has the other things they're working on, but this is one of those shows where everyone really did want to keep working together, and so we're all finding ways to do that.
The cast will
more to come on that front, probably down the road, but I think being successful with this project just means that we're going to be able to keep doing more fun things down the road.
Are you saying there's a season 2 coming?
I'm not saying anything.
Lord of the Flies edition.
The Undersea spinoff animated adventure. No, there's nothing specific that we can share yet, but I think maybe there will be, but fingers crossed.
Thank you very much for your time. Please stay safe. And thank you so much for this show that really affected me very much.
Well, thank you for sharing in it. And thank you for your airport stories. The Schwarzenegger story is next level.
I'm keeping this one.
I have so many airport stories. You don't know.
Yeah, the teeth too. Come on. Yeah, this is good stuff.
Thanks, Christina.
Thank you.
Thanks, Christina.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much to Patrick Somerville and Jessica Rhodes. Station 11 is on HBO Max now. Go check it out. And thank you so much for listening. Please subscribe to Pop Culture Confidential wherever you get your podcasts and rate and review the show. Spotify has a new feature where you can rate the podcasts you're listening to. So if you're so inclined, go give us that 5-star rating. Thank you so much. See you next time.
You've watched them in unforgettable adventures, love affairs, and tragedies. Now it's time to hear their own remarkable stories. From the makers of Death of a Rockstar and Death of a Sports Star, this is Death of a Film Star. Starring Heath Ledger, Marilyn Monroe, Chadwick Boseman, Robin Williams, Carrie Fisher, and Bruce Lee. Search for Death of a Film Star in your podcast app. You've seen them tell stories. Now it's time to tell theirs.